Hey there. Before getting into today's episode, let me tell you about a great history podcast that you should absolutely know about. One Mic Black History is a very well produced and excellently written record of African American history. Specifically, fans of my show should love One Mic because it focuses on the little or known aspects of African American history. I particularly loved the latest episode on Black Eden, a Midwestern resort town designed to give African Americans an affordable, yet luxurious place to enjoy their vacations. If I were doing a wine pairing for podcasts, I would think that Obscure History's Bay Ocean episode and One Mic's Black Eden episode would go together like a good Malbec and chunk of Asiago. I actually don't drink, but Google told me these things go together. Check the link in my bio to subscribe to One Mic today. It was General Sherman who once said, "I am tired and sick of war. Its glory is all moonshine. It is only those who have neither fired a shot nor heard the shrieks and groans of the wounded who cry aloud for blood, for vengeance, for desolation. War is hell." I'm not sure that there is a quote in written language that I agree with more. My name is Josh, and this is Obscure History. Long ago, there were two boys. One was born in the land of the rising sun, where mountains loom above verdant flora and the sun dances gracefully on many lakes and ponds, where sacred temples lie reverently under a canopy of treetops, and lighthouses perch atop jutting rocks guiding sailors through violent Pacific waves. The other was born in the land of twisting evergreens, where tall pines spin like fingers reaching towards the heavens, and soft green moss stretches across the forest floor. Where men and women rise before dawn to trudge into the woods to harvest lumber, the lifeblood of their community, or to the docks to pull fish from the churning Pacific Ocean. For a time, each of these boys were blinded by the magic of the world. The earth gave richly, and all people were heroes. Things were simply easy. However, as unfortunately happens to us all, the beauty and magic in the world was stripped from these two boys eventually. Though they touched the same water and watched the same sun rise and cast its rays through dense canopies of trees, these two boys would eventually be at war. They would train, first themselves and then others, to fight and kill and maim each other. They would take up the flag of their nations and would follow their orders into the trenches and into the skies. But these two boys were stronger and more resilient than their circumstance. And perhaps we can learn something from their tale. This is the story of Nobuo Fujita and James Douglas Peterson. War is hell. I've said it 1,000 times on this show, and I will say it 1,000 times more. There is nothing that I abhor more about being a human being than war. It's a huge area of focus in the study of history and in pop culture. Think of some of your favorite film or book series. I'm sure that war is a major plot point of some kind. Think Game of Thrones, Lord of the Rings, Band of Brothers, etc., etc., and so on, seemingly forever. War is just a deep part of our culture. We ask a lot of questions about war, like who started it, what weapons did they use, where did they get their resources, how long did it last, what were their strategies. But a question that we don't often ask is why. And not just why did World War I start? People have asked those questions millions of times, and there are plenty of very deep books and documentaries specifically to answer them. But we don't often ask the question, why do we fight? Like, why is war a thing that we do as humans? There is an incredible series of letters between two of the greatest minds of the 20th century, Albert Einstein and Sigmund Freud, that might hold some clues to answering that very elusive and oft-neglected question. Einstein begins the correspondence by reaching out to Freud. He says, "Dear Professor Freud, is there any way of delivering mankind from the menace of war? It is common knowledge that, with the advance of modern science, this issue has come to mean a matter of life and death for civilization as we know it. Nevertheless, for all the zeal displayed, every attempt at its solution has ended in lamentable breakdown." Though I cannot read the entire letter, because it is quite lengthy, I can break down Einstein's further inquiries as such. How is it possible for this small clique to bend the will of the majority who stand to lose and suffer by state of war to the service of their ambitions? How is it these devices succeed so well in rousing men to such wild enthusiasm, even to sacrifice their lives? And is it possible to control man's mental evolution so as to make him proof against psychoses of hate and destructiveness? Freud responds by writing, "Conflicts of interest between man and man are resolved in principle by recourse to violence. It is the same in the animal kingdom from which man cannot claim exclusion. Nevertheless, men are also prone to conflicts of opinion, touching on occasion the loftiest peaks of abstract thought, which seem to call for settlement by quite another method. This refinement, however, is a late development." To start with, brute force was the factor which, in small communities, decided points of ownership and the question of which man's will was to prevail. Very soon, physical force was implemented, then replaced by the use of various adjuncts. He proved the victor whose weapon was better or handled more skillfully. Now, for the first time with the coming of weapons, superior brains began to oust brute force, but the object of the conflict remained the same. One party was to be constrained, by the injury done to him or impairment of his strength, to retract a claim or a refusal. This end is most effectively gained when the opponent is definitely put out of action, in other words, is killed. He concludes by saying, "I pass on to another point the basis, as it strikes me, of our common hatred of war. It is this: we cannot do otherwise than hate it. Pacifists we are, since our organic nature wills us thus to be. Hence it comes easy to us to find arguments that justify our standpoint. This point, however, calls for elucidation. Here is the way in which I see it. The cultural development of mankind, some, I know, prefer to call it civilization, has been in progress since immemorial antiquity. To this phenomenon we owe all that is best in our composition, but also much that makes for human suffering. Its origins and causes are obscure, its issue is uncertain, but some of its characteristics are easy to perceive. The psychic changes which accompany this process of cultural change are striking, and not to be gainsaid. They consist in the progressive rejection of instinctive ends and a scaling down of instinctive reactions. Sensations which delighted our forefathers have become neutral or unbearable to us, and, if our ethical and aesthetic ideals have undergone a change, the causes of this are ultimately organic. On the psychological side, two of the most important phenomena of culture are firstly a strengthening of intellect which tends to master our instinctive life, and secondly, an introversion of the aggressive impulse, with all of its consequent benefits and perils. Now, war runs most emphatically center to the psychic disposition imposed on us by the growth of culture. We are therefore bound to resent war, to find it utterly intolerable. With pacifists like us, it is not merely an intellectual and affective repulsion, but a constitutional intolerance, an idiosyncrasy in the most dramatic form. And it would seem that the aesthetic ignominies of warfare play almost a large part in the repugnance of war's atrocities. How long must we have to wait for the rest of men to turn pacifist? Impossible to say. And yet perhaps our hope that these two factors, man's cultural disposition and a well-founded dread of the form that future wars will take, may serve to put an end to war in the near future. But by what ways or byways this will come about, we cannot guess. Meanwhile, we may rest on the assurance that whatever makes for cultural development is working also against war. To summarize briefly, because I know Einstein and Freud are both difficult to read or listen to, it seems as if they believe that we could cure our addiction to warfare by increasing the average intellect of Earth's citizens and by exposing them to each other's cultures. But what does that have to do with those two boys? We'll find out in about 90 seconds, but for now we need to pay the bills, so hang tight, you're going to hear a few quick messages from our sponsors, and when we get back, we're going to get into the incredible true story of Nobuo Fujita and James Douglas Peterson. Though Japan and the United States have been close allies for decades since World War II, there was a time where the two nations were furious and bitter rivals. The bombing of Pearl Harbor prompted the United States to join the Allied powers and enter World War II, and as warfare goes, the U.S. retaliated, then Japan retaliated, and the U.S. retaliated to those retaliations until eventually Japan surrendered under the weight of two ungodly bombs. Most people know the major plot points: Pearl Harbor, Iwo Jima, atomic bombs. Those moments seem to live forever in our minds. But many people don't realize that the Oregon coast was an active battlefield at certain points during the war. Eventually, as author Lee Juliarrett states, Japan would launch more than 9,000 balloon bombs, experimental weapons intended to kill and cause fires. The balloons, each carrying an anti-personnel bomb and two incendiary bombs, took about 70 hours to cross the Pacific Ocean. 361 of the balloons have been found in 26 states, Canada, and Mexico. The balloon bombs were 70 feet tall with a 33-foot diameter paper canopy connected to the main device by shroud lines. Balloons inflated with hydrogen followed the jet stream at an altitude of 30,000 feet. The high-explosive anti-personnel and incendiary devices were rigged to self-destruct and leave no evidence. The Japanese hoped the bombs would start forest fires and create panic, according to documents found after the war. These bombs were actually so prevalent that the government actually created a training video for how to handle these weapons. This video was eventually declassified to the public after some of the bombs made landfall without detonating.
This is one of the Japanese paper balloons, identified by the codename Paper. The unit carries up to 4 10-pound incendiaries and a central payload of about 60 pounds of incendiary or anti-personnel HE bombs. To drop on the west coast of the United States and Canada. It is then supposed to destroy itself.
Now, most of these bombs were ineffective. However, the Mitchell Monument outside of Bly, Oregon, marks the spot where 6 people were killed by one of these experimental weapons. It was designated by the National Register of Historic Places in 2003. This is the only place on the continental United States where Americans were killed by enemies in action during World War II. Juliarrett recounts, on May 5, 1945, Bly minister Archie Mitchell, his pregnant wife Elise, and 5 children from Mitchell's Sunday school class were on a Saturday morning picnic, 13 miles northeast of Bly, or about 60 miles northeast of Klamath Falls. Mitchell parked the car, and Elise and the children headed to Leonard Creek. Mitchell later remembered, "As I got out of the car to bring the lunch, the others were not far away and called to me that they had found something that looked like a balloon. I heard of Japanese balloons, so I shouted a warning not to touch it, but just then there was a big explosion. I ran up there and they were all dead." The explosion created a deep, 3-foot-wide hole. Bomb fragments were found 400 feet from the explosion site. 6 people died: Elise Mitchell, 26, Dick Patsky, 14, Jay Gifford, 13, Edward Engen, 13, Joan Patsky, 13, and Sherman Shoemaker, 11. And before that tragedy, the Oregon coast saw further activity. In June 1942, the Japanese submarine I-25, commanded by Meiji Tagami, opened fire from the mouth of the Columbia River on Fort Stevens, which was a drastically outdated fort. Luckily, despite firing 17 shells, none of them caused any damage. This is largely due to the leadership at Fort Stevens' quick thinking. They assumed that their old guns would be out of range, and further assumed that if they kept the fort totally blacked out, the submarine wouldn't be able to pin down their location. And in these assumptions, they were completely correct. The shells hit a baseball field, some swampland, a few power lines, and some fields. But no serious damage was caused in the assault. However, from that same submarine, a young man named Nobuo Fujita had a devious idea. We don't know much about Nobuo Fujita's childhood. We know that he was born in Japan. My suspicion is that he was raised or spent significant time in the Ibaraki Prefecture. However, that's mostly just inference. We know that he enlisted in the Japanese Imperial Army in 1932 and became a pilot shortly after. We know that he lost a brother in World War II. But what's most apparent about Fujita is that he was highly motivated and successful. He was involved in the attack on Pearl Harbor and afterwards was sent on a mission to menace the waters around Australia. He flew many reconnaissance missions for the Japanese Navy in his seaplane. He was on the deck of the I-25 during the bombardment of Fort Stevens. And it was Fujita that proposed an interesting and risky tactic to divide the power of the U.S. military. The I-25 was a unique submarine in that it was also an aircraft carrier. From the I-25, Nobuo Fujita conducted reconnaissance missions at various times and participated in small air raids. In order to fit inside the submarine, his seaplane was relatively small, so large-scale bombing runs was out of the question, but Fujita proposed a creative solution. He asked his superiors if he could drop individual incendiary bombs in the Oregon forests in hopes that they would spark massive forest fires and would divert American resources. His superiors approved of his plans and they began plotting the attack. On September 9th at 0600 hours, Fujita launched from the I-25 off the Oregon coast. He flew his small seaplane over the small logging community of Brookings, Oregon. Because of heavy morning fog, residents reported hearing the plane, but could not see it. Fujita found his target, a large patch of forest on the side of Mount Emily. He released his bomb, and watched as it made connection with the ground. It erupted violently in a flash of heat and energy, its incendiary components instantly turning to molten slag, working its way through the heavy underbrush. And as he turned his plane in retreat, he saw a small snake of smoke climbing its way up to the sky. Though the mission was technically successful, Fujita and his superiors underestimated the Oregon wilderness. The perpetually damp Oregon forests practically absorbed the fire, and with a little help from the U.S. Forest Service, the attack was quickly squashed. Despite being the only time enemy forces attacked the continental United States during World War II, the incident was largely unreported and was quickly forgotten. Fujita would go on to train kamikaze pilots towards the end of the war. After the war ended, Fujita did what most tried to do. He tried to move on. He tried to put the memories of his actions somewhere deep inside, buried underneath tradition, mundanity, love, and aspiration. He tried to hide himself from himself. He moved back to Ibaraki Prefecture. He opened a hardware store, and when that didn't pan out, he worked for a company manufacturing wire. For a while, I'm sure that he felt as if he really could bury his past. However, a young man, the president of the Brookings Junior Chamber of Commerce, James Douglas Peterson, had other plans for Fujita. But that is a story for another day. Join me next week as I finish the amazing tale of shame, hatred, forgiveness, redemption, and friendship. The story of Nobuo Fujita and James Douglas Peterson is so incredible, it deserves to have two parts. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. I appreciate you all so much. Before I get too far, as always, this episode was brought to you in part by Earbuds Podcast Collective and Indie Drop-In Network. If you've been having a hard time finding your new second favorite show, go to one of those services and they will hook you up. Earbuds Podcast Collective is a weekly newsletter that will drop new shows into your inbox, and Indie Drop-In Network is a podcast feed that you can subscribe to, and they will deliver new independently produced podcasts right into your favorite podcasting app for you, so you can really try out some new shows that you probably would never be able to find otherwise. So I'm a little sorry that this one's kind of short. It's not super short, but it's a little bit short. It was either going to be a very, very long one episode or a two-part series with kind of short episodes. So I elected to do a two-parter because this story is so incredible. I couldn't bear to do it injustice. This is one of my favorite pieces of Oregon history, and I'm super excited to tell you guys about it. But also, I promise I will go to other states and other parts of the world eventually. Every time I sit down to write an episode, I feel this severe pull to do an Oregon story, and I don't know why. There's just so much of it. That's kind of the great and terrible thing about history, isn't it? Like, there's just an endless amount of interesting things to write about if you look hard enough. I don't really have any personal announcements. I apologize that I didn't release a Thursday footnotes this last week. It would have released on my birthday, and I was a little too busy to record. I'm hoping that I can get one out this week, but I've got some work-related things that are eating up a lot of my time, and that's totally fine. It's all good things. So anyways, just for the super, super short version of Thursday Footnotes, since I didn't have it, interesting things that didn't make it into the episode were the fact that Herbert Galembo actually had a son who went to jail for killing multiple people in a reckless driving incident. I wasn't able to track down the entire family tree, but I'm a little nervous that there are more of the Galembo family out there that might not be very happy with the episode that I did, so I didn't want to look too hard. I couldn't really get into the sources, which was another reason why I didn't do one, because I literally got every piece of information about that story from newspapers.com, and I cannot share those sources with you because they're behind a paywall. I mean, I suppose if you also subscribe to newspapers.com, I could share the clips with you, but unfortunately, I can't share them with you. If I try, you'll just get like a screen that wants you to subscribe, which you should, because newspapers.com is great. They're not an official sponsor, but I am hoping that maybe someday they will be. Okay, guys, I'm just going to play out this cool new Thursday Footnotes beat provided to us for free by our goddess over on Twitch. If you want to watch some Pokemon action and or some beat-making action, go to twitch.tv, subscribe to Our Goddess. It's going to be a good time, no matter what they're streaming, which is varied and fun. Okay, I got to get out of here. I got work in the morning. I hope you guys have a nice week.
That peoples of all faiths, all races, all nations may have their great human needs satisfied. That those now denied opportunity shall come to enjoy it to the full. That all who yearn for freedom may experience its spiritual blessings. Those who have freedom will understand also its heavy responsibility. That all who are insensitive to the needs of others will learn charity, and that the sources, scourges of poverty, disease, and ignorance will be made disappear from the earth. And that in the goodness of time, all peoples will come to live together in a peace guaranteed by the binding force of mutual respect and love.